First, I would like to thank Laura for the great job she's done of setting this up and for promotion. I think we should give her and the other people at Synergy a hand for their great work. And I'd also like to thank Dr. Julia for his wonderful work. And where's, I don't know if John Zerzan's here, but if he is, well, even if he's not, I'd still like to thank him for his great work. This, by the way, is how I know we're not going to have a revolution. Because if people will pay for water bottled in plastic, they will suffer any indignity. So I'm not really sure what we should do today. I had a few ideas. We could either talk about the culture of make-believe, or we could sort of go straight to Q&A, or we could talk about the book I'm working on right now, which is a book about how to take down civilization. Yes. I have to tell you, it is so good to be back in the West. Because of the response you just gave, I just did an East Coast tour, New England, and whenever I would say that my new book is about how to take down civilization, they would all look at me and go, So it's so great to be back where people know what the hell's going on. So I was thinking that since we have a choice, you know, since there's multiple things we could do, that since we live in a democracy, that's actually my best joke of the afternoon, we could take a vote. And then I would just go ahead and ignore you and do whatever the hell I want to do anyway. You know, I'll tell you why there is not going to be an anarchist revolution. Because I was down in Florida a couple years ago doing a talk, and then afterwards about 10 or 11, that was about 12 or 13 of us anarchists were going to go out to dinner. We stood in the parking lot for 45 minutes trying to come to consensus on who was going to get in which car. And we never did. Actually, never did come to consensus. Finally, this one woman said, okay, you three this car, you four this car, you three this car. I'm like, cool, great. So that's how the revolution is going to come, is just this woman has to call it. So that said, we did get, I was sort of thinking it might be kind of fun to just go straight to Q&A, but it was a really positive response for the takedown civilization stuff. So why don't I just, yeah, for which? Okay. The people have spoken. Can somebody make the lighting less terrible? I'm very dim. I was bright and then I got dim. You know, I was at Syracuse, New York last spring, and we couldn't make the AV system work. And I don't think you can say you've lived until you've seen a half dozen anarcho-primitivists try to work an AV system. So is this better?
Yes.
Are we happy now? Okay. So are you gonna stay here on call? Or are you gonna?
I think I should. Is there anything else anyone needs?
Hey, can we do stereo effects? Okay, so what I'm doing with the new book, I'm on about, it's pretty funny because after language, which was pretty big, and then culture, which was really big, my former publisher challenged me to write a short book, so I wrote two, and then this new book on how to take down civilization, I think I'm on page 526, I think. I'm about halfway done. It's another big one. Okay, so what I'm doing in the new book is I'm going through and I'm stating my premises in boldface. And the reason I'm doing that is because I've heard it said that the first rule of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. So, for example, and I don't want to do that. So, for example, if you hear a talking head say, how can we best make the U.S. economy grow? Okay, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell's we? But they've got you asking different questions. Of Hitler, it was said that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. And that's really true, once again. Once you accept certain premises, you can go ahead and commit whatever atrocities you want and have them fully rationalized. And once again, I don't want to do that. Okay, so we're going to jump tracks here, which is not going to surprise anybody who's read any of my books. And we're going to go a different direction for a second. And I think it's pretty safe to say that the environmental movement is an abysmal failure. And almost no matter what measure you go by, we're not winning. We don't even slow, not only do we not slow the rate of deforestation, we don't even slow the rate of acceleration of deforestation. And I'm sure you know that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And the head of the National Marine Fisheries Service did give an important response to that. And NIMS, of course, is the organization that is tasked with overseeing the murder of the oceans. And what his response was just a direct quote, "We have to ask what level of decline is reasonable or sustainable." As a longtime grassroots environmental activist and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and fall into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed, and I've sat silent near empty streams that two generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of all those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use that lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, "So Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that horses were afraid to get in the water for fear that, well, because they were afraid, and maybe so large that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they'd capsize, so large they'd keep people awake at night with the slapping of their tails against the water. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darken the sky for days at a time, the death of flocks of Eskimo crews just as large. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take dioxin in every mother's breast milk. Maybe it'll take global warming. Give me a specific threshold, Derek, a specific point at which you'll finally use that word." Thanks, George. So I read a really interesting book a few years ago called The Nazi Doctors by Robert J. Lifton. And in this book, he asked the question, how is it that these people who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could go in and participate in a death camp? And he found something very interesting, which is that many of the doctors actually acted in the best interests of the Jews, and they did everything they could to help improve the condition of the Jews, except question the larger framing conditions in which they found themselves. So if a Jew got sick, they might hand him an aspirin to lick, or they might put him to bed for a couple days. Or if he had a contagious disease, they might kill him so that he wouldn't give this disease to others. And his point was that they were doing all these wonderful things that they could. Wonderful is kind of ironic. But they were doing the best they could within the Auschwitz reality. They weren't questioning assembly line mass murder. They weren't questioning working them to death, starving them to death. They weren't questioning the overall cultural racism that led to this. And I think a lot of us as environmentalists end up finding ourselves in similar positions, that we're doing what pathetically little is available to us without questioning the larger superstructure. So that's one of the things I want to do today, is try to sort of blow out that superstructure as much as possible. Okay, premise one of the current book is industrial civilization. We got off the word industrial, but industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. A few years ago, I was riding a car with a friend of mine, George Raffin, and I was just making conversation. I said, "So, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be?" And George can be kind of a curmudgeon, and that day he was in kind of a foul mood and said, "You know, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the only level of technology that's sustainable is the Stone Age. And we will be there again someday, and the only question is what's going to be left of the world when we get there." It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the use of non-renewable resources isn't going to last. In fact, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources, whereby there are fewer salmon who come back every year than the year before, isn't sustainable. In fact, you can also say, and I think this is really true, that any way of life based on the use of resources isn't sustainable, because resources don't actually exist. There is no such thing as a resource. What there are salmon whose lives are as valuable to them as ours are to us, and trees whose lives are as valuable to them as ours are to us, and rivers whose lives are as valuable to them. And it's only after they're converted to resources. It's like there's this great line by this Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And what that means is, when he looks at trees, he doesn't see trees. He sees, obviously, dollar bills. He sees resources. And if you see them as resources, you're going to use them up. And this doesn't mean, and we're jumping again, no surprise, but this doesn't mean that you can't eat them, you can't kill them. A few years ago, I was doing an interview in Spokane, Washington, and the radio interviewer said, well, you know, Indians ate salmon too. Oh, no, I'm sorry, I didn't say that. He said, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. And he said, what's the difference? And I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. And it was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, so I had to give an answer. And that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to a tree, and I asked the tree, so what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer just like that, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. So if I eat salmon from a particular run, I'm now responsible for that run's continuation. And if a grizzly bear eats salmon, they're now responsible for that continuation. And this is true on a moral level, it's true on a spiritual level, it's true on a physical level, because if you don't do it, the run's not going to continue, as we see. And everybody knows this. Wood ducks know it, tadpoles know it, frogs know it, grizzly bears know it, everybody but us, everybody but a few of us. Okay, so that's fine, Derek, that civilization is not and can never be sustainable, but what is civilization? You know, I've been bashing civilization for about 10 years, and I figure it's finally time I better define it. And the definition that I've come up with, which I think is really defensible, is civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's really fine, Derek, but what's a city? So a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And a couple things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. The first of them is, which means, by the way, that the Talawa and Yurok, who lived and still live where I live, weren't civilized. They lived in villages, they lived in camps. And I'm using civilization as pejorative, by the way. And they didn't require the importation of resources. The Talawa and Yurok would eat salmon, huckleberry, salal, salmon, elk, salmon, crabs, salmon, clams, salmon. They would also, I don't know if you know this, but they'd also eat salmon. And anyway, so a couple things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is your way of life is not and can never be sustainable. Because if you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, once again, I don't believe in resources, but it's shorthand here. If you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, that means that and you require its importation, as your city grows, you're going to denude an ever larger area of that particular resource, as we see. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if the people in the next watershed over aren't going to trade you for this item, and if you need it, you're going to take it. And so what this means is that we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and it wouldn't matter. The U.S. would still have a large military, because how the hell else are we going to get access to all the oil that we need? So we could all hold hands and sing Give Peace a Chance, and the military is going to march on. Okay. The second premise of the book is that traditional communities don't often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. Following quick on that is the third premise. Our way of living, is based on requires and would collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. Oh, and then we get to a really fun one. This is a great premise. Okay, civilization is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted yet often unarticulated hierarchy. And violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is either transparent or fully rationalized. And violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is met with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And the way this can work on a family level, those of you who read language know that my father is extremely violent. Broke my sister's arm. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And within our family, the violence would flow that direction. He could be violent with impunity. But the one time that my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he committed blasphemy. And similarly, I don't know if it's been in the paper here, all over New England people had heard about this, that a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, there was a mountain biker killed by a mountain lion down in L.A. And this, of course, makes news everywhere. But not many people know that they're building houses on some of the last Florida panther habitat in Florida. And so it's very, you know, one time, you know, the one time that a shark bites a human, that's a big deal. But sharks are being driven systematically extinct. And, you know, I don't really like Bob Melvin. I think he should be fired. It's a baseball joke. So similarly, there's you know, when there were 3,000 people killed on 9/11, that's a big deal. But there's more people than that die of preventable cancer in the United States every like 3 or 4 days. There's more children than that die around the world because of U.S. domestic and foreign policies every same deal 3 or 4 days. And so there's this fetishization of the victims when it goes the other direction. The fifth premise of the book is that the property of those higher on the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives below. So those above can acquire more property, that is, make more money, by destroying the lives of those below. But if those below destroy the property of those above, then the lives, and that's called, the first is called production, by the way, and if those below damage the property of those above can destroy the lives of those below, and that's called justice. And we all know the example, you know, Jeff Lures, 22 years for torching 3 SUVs, and which is far more than you get if a man rapes a woman or if a man beats his wife to death, his wife. So that's that hierarchy in operation. The sixth premise is a fun one, too. Civilization isn't redeemable. Our culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. I ask people all over the country, do you think that our culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Nobody ever says yes. A lot of people laugh, even in New England. And so the question becomes, if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know, because we don't talk about it, because we spend so much time trying to pretend that we have hope. And it's killing us. One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they co-opted rationality and they co-opted hope. And one of the ways they did that was by making it so that it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist at every step of the process. So, would you rather get an ID card or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? You want to move to a ghetto? You want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to get on a cattle car? Want to resist and possibly get killed? Want to take a shower? You want to resist and possibly get killed. At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something really interesting, which is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 years. Oh, we're going to jump another direction too, which is the 10th premise of the book is that the culture as a whole, most of its members are insane. I don't really need to talk about that, do I? If I could get across one thing in my work, it would be that the government is a government of occupation and the culture is a culture of occupation. And of course, all of my American Indian friends are telling me what the hell took me so long to figure that one out. I'll read a short little thing from the new book, if I can find it. Okay, here we go. If Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we all do? Yeah, we'd think about the baseball season. What would we all do if they implemented... Goddamn Grady Little, by the way, for keeping Pedro Martinez in. What would we all do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. That was Mussolini, by the way, not Chomsky. And what would we do if they then instituted laws allowing them to put a significant portion, say one-third, of all Jewish males from the ages of 18 and 35 into concentration camps? What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist, or following Mussolini, corporate party? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Oh, I'll tell you my secret fantasy, which won't be secret after this, which is that the next time they have one of those WTO or FTAA or whatever meetings, that all the cops suddenly turn around and they start shooting at the WTO representatives. Because they have a lot more in common with us than they do with them. And that's happened before. That actually happened. It was in 1880 in Pennsylvania. The militia handed over their guns to the strikers. It also happened at the Bastille, where when they stormed the Bastille, all the guards suddenly turned and killed their officers, which should always be encouraged. So would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Substitute the word African-American for Jewish and ask yourself the same questions. Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? What if they did this because... Hell, I can't finish that sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and toxify the landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forests, and from there to the boardrooms and to the halls of the Reichstag to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them the marching orders? It's like, we're all so crazy. If space aliens came down from outer space, I guess that's where they come from, if aliens came down from outer space and they started to systematically deforest the planet, to vacuum the oceans, and to give dioxin, to put dioxin in every mother's breast milk, every stream in the United States is contaminated with carcinogens. Every stream. I mean, it's amazing what we can do when we put our minds to it. And if they did that, I mean, what would we do? I mean, I think it's pretty clear that if space aliens were doing all of this, that we would all just put on our camo outfits and grab our AK-47s and head off to the woods. Am I like the only person here with an AK-47? Or has anybody seen the movie Red Dawn? Oh, isn't that the greatest? I love that movie. Okay, the movie is about the commies invade from Central America. The Cubans and Soviets come in through Nicaragua. They fly up to the United States. They don't fly United, and they never get here. And they get stopped in Colorado by a bunch of jocks and cheerleaders. And I think we should make that our theme movie, except just dub it. And every time they say commies, just put in capitalists, and there we go. That was a joke, Mr. Ashcroft. Okay. So maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'll fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape, but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put carcinogens into the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? How many people in here have loved someone who's died of cancer? No, I'm not going to say that. How many people have loved someone who got killed by cancer? That's what, 70, 80%? Which, of course, cancer is a disease of civilization. Who is the idiot who came up with the idea of putting poison on our own food? Would you fight back? What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion that their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? The head of South African security, after South Africa was no longer apartheid, the head of security before then said that the thing he'd really been afraid of with the ANC was not their sabotage or even the violence, as it was the possibility that they would convince the mass of people to not have respect for law and order. Because he said no security force in the world can deal with that. So if we can recognize that sometimes law and morality coincide, and quite often, of course, they don't. Anyway, would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues, or would you fight back? If you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold at which you finally take a stand. If you can't or won't give that threshold, why not? None of these questions are rhetorical. The questions are real. They are, at this point, some of the most important questions there are. So, when I say fight back, I don't mean only picking up guns. I mean, certainly that's one part. But the wonderful thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where we look, there's great work to be done. And so, if your heart carries you to work on a battered women's shelter, that's really important. If it carries you to work on a rape crisis hotline, that's great too. If it carries you to file timber sale appeals, great. I mean, even voting, for crying out loud. People ask me sometimes if I vote, and I say, you know, we all have these dirty habits that we're ashamed of. The thing is, there's this strategy that was used by Robert E. Lee at the Battle of Chancellorsville called Hammer and Anvil, where you take part of your army and you leave it here as the anvil, and you take part of your army here and you take it around and smash the enemy in between, and that's your hammer. And part of what I think we need to do, we have a fair number of people acting as anvils, and I don't think we have enough people acting as hammers to try to go on the offensive. All of our environmental work is really, for the most part, is pretty defensive. And I mean, I can't speak for any of you, but it's not good enough for me to simply have salmon or grizzly bears or lynx or bobcat live out another generation or two of harried life before they ultimately get exterminated. You know, I want more than that. I want to actually live in a world where there's more wild salmon come back every year than the year before, and more migratory songbirds, and where there's... I'll do what it takes to get there. Which actually brings us back to hope, that one of the things that kept my mother in the relationship with my father was the false hope that he would change. And another thing that kept her in the relationship, obviously, was that there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But the main one that I want to talk about is the false hope that he would change. And I was at a dinner get-together thing not very long ago with an attorney from what used to be Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, I guess it's Earth Justice now, and also with a funder for Earth Justice. And there's some other people too there too. And the attorney was saying, you know, if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things are going to be okay. And, you know, if we can just take over the House and Senate, and, you know, I was thinking, well, maybe, if it depends on who we is. I mean, if she means Democrats, then no. But I don't think she also meant storming the House and Senate either. So they're saying all this about how, you know, if we could just get a Democrat in the White House, things would be okay. And my mom was at the dinner, and she said, you know, the Democrats are just as controlled by corporations as the Republicans are. And everybody sort of leaned away and wrinkled their noses as though my mom had just explosively farted. And there was silence for a few moments, and then somebody said, I'm sorry, could you pass me the chips, please? And then, of course, I started talking about baseball. And anyway, so does anybody really believe that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? And does anybody think that Monsanto is going to stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? And false hopes bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. I mean, that was what kept the Jews in line, you know, the false hope that if they are just good enough, perfect enough, that the dreadful won't happen. But But I don't want to just bash false hope. I actually want to bash hope, too. I was at a talk last spring, and you know, I was just doing my fun little bashing hope thing, and somebody said in the audience said, "So can you define hope, please?" I was like, "Oh shit, I've never done that. I mean, I've been bashing it for years. I have no idea what it is." And so I asked the audience, "Can you come up with a definition of hope?" And they did, and it was a great definition. Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Because I don't hope I'm going to eat something this evening. You know, they say males are afraid of commitment. I'm committing to it in public right here. I'm going to eat something tonight. And on the other hand, the next time I get on an airplane, I hope it doesn't crash. I have no control over that. So the point is, if you say, "I hope that salmon survive," what you're doing is you're acknowledging that you're fundamentally powerless. I don't hope that coho and Chinook salmon survive. Once again, I will do what it takes to make sure they survive. If they want to go extinct because they don't like how they're being treated, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they don't want to go extinct, they're not going to go extinct because I won't allow it to happen. I mean, it's really simple. What we need to do, if we want to make sure salmon don't go extinct, once again, as long as they don't want to go extinct, and who could blame them, frankly, is we need to take out dams, we need to stop deforestation, we need to stop global warming, and we need to stop commercial fishing. And those are all very straightforward technical tasks. If this were space aliens doing it, 1, 2, 3, 4, done deal. Okay, the longer, if our culture is not going to undergo any sort of voluntary transformation, if we don't put a halt to it, civilization will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm the humans and non-humans for a very long time. Seventh premise. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. If somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 150 years ago, the people in this region would still have a lot of salmon to eat. If it would have happened 200 years ago, people in the Midwest and New England would still have passenger pigeons to eat. I mean, passenger pigeons and salmon and Eskimo curlews and all of them have the right to survive. Of course, we'll talk about rights in a second. Have the right to survive on their own, but even on the level of straight calories. You know, there's going to be people 50 years from now on the Columbia River, they'll be glowing for one thing, and they'll be saying, "Now, there are no salmon here, and I'm starving to death because you allowed those in power to have cheap electricity for beer cans." And that's not a legacy, once again, I'm willing to bear. The longer we wait, if somebody would have brought down civilization, whatever that means, 80 years ago, there wouldn't be dioxin in every mother's breast milk. The longer we wait, the worse that's going to be. Eighth premise, the needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of our economic system. I'll say it again. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of our economic system. Can you imagine any politician saying that? It's just so, it's absolutely absurd. The psychiatrist R.D. Lang came up, oh my God, oh we have 45 minutes, good, I was thinking we had like 15 minutes left. Anyway, the psychiatrist R.D. Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, which are also the three rules of a dysfunctional culture. Rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A, A1, or A2. And what this meant within my own family structure is that we could talk about anything we wanted except for the violence that wasn't happening. And then, of course, we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the violence wasn't happening. And we also couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the violence wasn't happening. And then, in addition, we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the fact that we couldn't talk about the violence wasn't happening. One more thing. We couldn't talk about the fact that 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 we couldn't talk about the violence wasn't happening. Because if we would have talked about the fact that we couldn't talk 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 about the violence that wasn't happening, there would have been violence happening for us to not be talking about. Is that clear? And on the larger social scale, we can talk for years about whether the president did or didn't get a blowjob, but we can't talk about the corporations that are killing the planet. We can talk about Pedro Martinez and why did they spend so much on Raul Ibanez? I mean, I think he's pretty good, but in one good year, and he gets, what is it, $4 million or something? It's insane. I don't know if this happens to you, but sometimes a vision of Angelina Jolie will rise up before me. She'll stand suspended in space. Makes me happy. It also makes me a little nervous, too. I don't think she has very good taste in men. Who's the new guy? God damn him. He's a bad boy too, but it's an improvement over Billy Bob. Oh my God. You know the thing about the vial? He each had a vial of the other person's blood around their neck? Do you know that? And then do you know where she has his name tattooed? Oh my God, I bet she was wishing his name was Ed. Speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in the newspaper, so it has to be true. I'm sorry, does anybody know what's the indigenous name for this place? No, this place. I'm sorry?
Cheatwood.
And what's the indigenous name? What did the indigenous people...
That's where it was.
Oh, okay. 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 I find it really strange that I know what is on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not on Nicole Kidman's, but it took me about 2 years of living where I do to learn that there was a massacre of about 250 Indians about 2 miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket. And then if you go another mile, there was another massacre at a place called Achillet. And if you go a mile over here, there was a massacre at a place called Lake Earl. And it's so weird that I know that Yvonne Rodriguez just signed a 4-year contract with the Detroit Tigers, and which I think is a little bit... 4 years for a catcher his age, I think, is not a very good move. And I can't name 15 species of plants and animals who live within 150 yards of my home who've been harmed by civilization. I can't even name 10 species of plants who live within 100 yards of my home that are edible. Blackberry, huckleberry, salal, blackberry. You know, somebody told me that, I mean, I know about dandelions, but the local dandelions actually aren't dandelions, I found out, and they're actually not, down where I live, in Northern California, they're actually not edible. I found that out. I was thinking, I know they're not plants, but it's close enough. Those big red mushrooms with the white dots, I'm thinking about trying one of them next year. Well, there's lots of them, so yeah, I could probably survive all winter on them. Anyway, and they do have bites out of them, by the way. I'm thinking it's probably little rabbits or something. Anyway, I think it's really weird. Oh, and it's not just the Artie Lang's rules that make it so we don't pay attention to the things. And we're talking about the vacuuming of the oceans. Oh, here we go. Here's a little quiz. So seeing patterns is supposed to be one form of intelligence. I'm gonna throw out this pattern. We'll see if we can recognize a pattern in less than 6,000 years. Okay, so when you think of a rack, is the first thing you think of like cedar forests that are so thick that the sunlight never reaches the ground? That's actually what I think of. The first written myth of this culture is that Gilgamesh went out and cut the forests of what is now Iraq. And then we think of Saudi Arabia, and the first thing you think of course, is dense oak forests, right? And then you go a little bit further west to like Lebanon, and you think of cedars. I mean, they've got one on the flag. And then Israel, I talked to this guy from Israel a couple years ago, and I said, do you have trees in Israel? And I don't know, I've never been there. And he said, yeah, we water them one by one. And Greece had lions and was heavily forested. Italy was heavily forested. When you think of North Africa, Libya, I mean, I think of just dense forests immediately. It just, this, as this culture has metastasized across the globe, it's been deforesting its way all around. There's a great line by Plato, I believe it is. Plato observed, "What now remains of the hills, compared with what then existed, is like the skeleton of a sick man, all the fat and soft earth having wasted away, and only the bare framework of the land being left. There are some mountains which now have nothing but food for bees, but they had trees not very long ago." It's like, I just read not very long ago that there was some king in England, like 13th century or something, outlawed dams because they kill salmon. And nowadays, I mean, the power planning council is still studying whether dams kill salmon. It's all pretty pathetic. Pretty bobo pathetic. Any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it's based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence, as well as justice, requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least, disallowing it from damaging your land base. Oh, I never finished my deal a minute ago about the perception, that it's not just Artie Lang's rules that make it so we can't see. In the 1960s, this guy Lester Laborsky did this experiment where he attached electrodes to people's eyeballs, and they would track where they would look, which makes me think it was probably John Ashcroft's uncle or something. And it's like, here you go, Johnny, a nice little Christmas present. And what he found, he showed people photographs, and what he found is if the photograph contained something that the person found morally objectionable or that threatened their worldview, their eyes would never once track to it, not once. Which means that they would see it out of the corner of their eye and they would know where not to look. So, for example, he showed people photographs. In the background was a man reading a newspaper, and the foreground was a silhouette of a woman's breast. And the people who found nudity morally objectionable, their eyes would never once track to the breast. Never once. And when they were asked later, was there a breast in the photograph, they would say no. And they weren't lying, except unconsciously to themselves, because they never saw it. They never looked there. It's like I had this friend who said she wishes she could just shake George Bush, which I like that part. And then she said, I would just say to him, you know, that you could do so much to slow deforestation or stop deforestation. How about that? So much to stop global warming, so much to stop militarization, huh? And I said to her, look, I know exactly what he would say to you. He would say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Which, of course, with George Bush would come from multiple sources. And it's like the head DEA guy in Colombia several years ago, his wife was arrested for smuggling drugs in the United States. And the story they told was that she was doing lines of cocaine in front of him, and he would walk through the room and never see it. It's possible that this was a story they told to keep him out of prison. It's also possible that it would have been so threatening to his perception of their marriage that he could not see it. He absolutely couldn't see it. We don't have to go. We do this all the time. I mean, I don't know if I'm the only person in this room who's ever been in a really shitty relationship. It's nice to be among a support group. Thank you. I mean, there's nothing worse than me saying that at the talk, and it's just dead silence in the room. It's like, well, I'm feeling kind of vulnerable now. Anyway, so I mean, there was no evidence at all that she's the single most selfish person in the entire world. The evidence wasn't there. And then you may have dated the same woman. And then when any of my friends would attempt to point this out to me, I would say, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? And then when the thing's over, it's like, oh my God, how did I not see that? And so once again, we do that. That's how we can have 80% of us have had someone we love killed by cancer, and we still just soldier on. Did I mention, by the way, that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along? Okay, here's another premise. There are no rich people in the world, and there are no poor people. There are just people. The rich may have lots of pieces of paper that many pretend are worth something, and the poor may not. The rich claim they own land, and the poor are denied the right to make the same claim. A primary purpose of the police is to enforce the delusions of those with lots of pieces of green paper. Those without the green papers generally buy into these delusions almost as quickly and completely as those with. These delusions carry with them extreme consequences in the real world. couple things about that. One of them is, well, I guess it's one thing. At one, a talk I did last year, afterwards, this one guy said, you know, you talk a lot about violence and this culture being based on violence, but I don't see it. You know, I'm not a violent guy. And I said, okay, first off, where's your shirt made? And he said, Bangladesh. I said, okay, do we even need to talk about that? He said, no. I said, next, do you pay rent? And he said, yes. I said, why do you pay rent? He said, because I don't own. I said, no, no, no. What would happen if you didn't pay rent? And he said, well, somebody would come and evict me. And I said, who? He said, well, sheriff. I said, what would happen if when the sheriff came, you invited them into your house? And you said, would you like some dinner? And then after dinner, you said, you know, it's been nice having you, but you're really not all that pleasant, so I would like for you to leave now, and I'm going to go to bed. What would the sheriff do? He said, well, the sheriff would pull out a gun, and he would force me out of the home. And I said, I see. So what you're telling me is that if you don't pay rent, somebody with a gun is going to come and force you out of your home. So the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, somebody is going to do violence to you if you don't. And he said, okay, I get it. And I said, also, do you ever get hungry? He said, yeah. I said, well, when you get hungry, do you go to the grocery store? He said, yeah. And I said, well, do you start eating? There's lots of food there. And he said, no, I don't. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, because if I do, then somebody with a gun will come and take me away. And I said, yeah, it's the same guy. He's a real asshole, isn't he? the point is, I think it's really weird that we have to actually pay to exist, to live on the planet, and we have to actually pay to eat. And if you don't, some asshole wearing a uniform is going to come with a gun and take you away. That's a really, really weird thing. Some bobo, sorry. Here's a great premise. Oh, we're doing great. Here's a great premise. Love does not imply pacifism. You get this all the time, that, you know, if you love enough, then that means that you'll never do any act of violence. And, well, first off, violence is just such a weird word. There should be, like, 135 words for violence, because there's a bazillion different types of... Well, there should be a bazillion words for violence, because there's a bazillion different types. I mean, it's one form of violence to rape and torture and mutilate and kill a child, and it's another form of violence entirely to step in and stop a person from doing that. And it's one form of violence to eat a carrot, and it's another form of violence to eat a cow, and it's another form of violence to... You know, those are all different. You can't use one word to describe all of them, but nonetheless, we're going to use that just like resource. We're going to condense it all for a second. Love doesn't imply pacifism. That a lot of people say if you just love enough that you would never do any act of violence. And I don't think that Mother Grizzly Bears would agree. I have a newspaper article above the space where I work that says, the headline is Mother Bear Charges Trains. And the trains had killed her two sons, and so she began to charge every train that came by. I grew up around animals, and I've lived around animals my whole life. And in my life, I have been attacked by mother horses, cows, chickens, hawks, eagles, hummingbirds, spiders, and mice who thought that I was attacking their children. And if a mother mouse is going to attack someone 6,000 times her size to protect those she loves... What's going on with us? She won, by the way. I think I'd like to read a couple things, and then I'd like to read three things, and then we'll do Q&A. Part of the problem really is identification. That's a really central part. With what or whom do you identify? The mother mouse identified with herself and those she loved. And, it's kind of like the other day. Somebody said to me, so how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I said, I didn't know we were in Iraq. I thought we were in Northern California. And the friend said, it's like, Derek, do I have to put up with this shit all the time? You know what I meant? How much longer do you think our soldiers are going to be in Iraq? And I said, they're not my soldiers. There's this great bumper sticker I saw, US out of North America. I really like that. So it's like, with whom do you identify? The attorney at that dinner was saying, you know, if we can take over the White House, she's identifying with the Democrats. Once again, with whom or what do you identify? Do you identify with your own body? Do you identify with your land base? Do you identify, you know, what are the things that are worth living for? What are the things that are worth dying for? What are the things that are worth fighting for? What are the things with whom and with what you identify? Anyway, so here's a little story about that. I go to the post office. Jim, my favorite clerk there, with whom I often chat as he processes the packages I'm mailing, comments on the heat. It's 85 or 86. He says, the second or third highest temperature on record here. I live in cool Northern California. It makes you think about global warming, he says. I nod and reply, 19,000 people dead in Europe from the heat. The damn newspapers don't even mention global warming. I don't mention that this is more than 6 times the number killed in the attacks in the World Trade Center. Jim likes my politics, but polite discourse generally demands we ignore many obvious things. Now it's his turn to nod. He says, did you see those pictures of glaciers melting in Europe? The climate's changing, I say, and those in power won't do anything about it. The culture has too much momentum, he responds, and those in charge have too much money and power for us to stop them. That's why, I say, my next book is about how to take down civilization. He looks at me for a moment. You can write a book about it, but you can't make it happen. I can help push in the right direction at the right times. I think that can make a difference. It'll come down all right, he says, and that pretty soon, but it won't be your doing. It'll be the system collapsing in on itself. This is a guy at the post office. There are many who know this, but few who speak it out loud. I say, we can hurry it up. It's going to be nasty, he responds. It already is nasty, I say. That nastiness is exactly why I bought a gun, he said, a 38. I'm about to say that's also exactly why I bought a gun a few years ago, but he carries my packages to the big bins and back. When he returns, he says, it's for myself. I don't know what he means. He says, I don't want to live like that. I say, I don't want to live like this. He says, I don't want to live like an animal. I say, I got news for you, Jim. You already are an animal. He says, I need my electricity. I can't live without it. I don't say anything. I think, is it worth it to you? He looks me straight in the eyes and says, I'm going to retire in January. Don't do this right now. Give me a couple years to enjoy my retirement. Okay, two more things to read. I want to say a couple more things first. One of them is that the most common words I ever hear spoken by an environmentalist anywhere, we're fucked. We're so fucked. So several years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine one night saying, she's a long-time environmentalist, saying, this work is just killing me. It's so hard. It's really painful. I said, yeah, I know it is. Then she said, unless it stopped, the dominant culture is going to kill everything on the planet, didn't it? I said, yeah, it is. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, it hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. And then she said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew was best to say all along, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I said that to her is because about 10 years ago, I was undergoing a similar collapse where I was just bursting into sobs several times a week. And, you know, I'd cry over the salmon and the grizzlies so much. And a lot of my environmentalist friends were saying, you know, Derek, just back off because the problems will be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew if tears are going to mean anything, I mean, if you're not going to cry over the death of the salmon, what are you going to cry about? And so one day I called this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian writer, activist, and I said, this work's really hard. It's really painful. It's killing me. She said, yeah, I know it does that. And I said, we're not going to make it to some... No, I didn't say that first. I said, unless it stops, the dominant culture is going to kill everything, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is. And I said, it has death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. And I said, it hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And I said, we're not going to make some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could say is because it normalized my despair. It let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that I could feel the pain and the sorrow. And it's just pain and sorrow. You know, it's just pain, it's just sorrow. And it's not so much the pain and sorrow that hurts as it is my resistance to it. And it let me know that I could feel all of those things and it wouldn't kill me. Or even better, that it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing, and you can still dance, and you can still make love, and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. The logic of the Nazis doesn't work on you anymore. And a question I get sometimes is, if things are so bad, why don't you just kill yourself? And the answer is that life is really, really good. I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we're really fucked and that life's really, really good. And there's a strange notion that if you understand how bad things are, that you have to go around being miserable all the time. But I'm actually really happy. And I'm really sad. I'm really full of rage. I'm full of joy. I'm full of a lot of things. I mean, it's like this person sent me an email a while back saying she wanted to know how my anger at the dominant culture affects my sex life. And I was really tempted to write back, you know, that's a question to which you will never know the answer. And what I was, I mean, but I really thought about it, and it's based on the idea that if you're angry, that your anger has to be a shotgun. But surprisingly enough, you know, if some specific person makes me angry, I can be angry at them. And if some specific thing makes me angry, I can be angry at it. That doesn't mean I have to be angry at you. I may be, goddammit. That we can separate. And the other question that I get a lot is, if things are so bad, why don't you just party? And the answer is, I don't really like parties. I'm actually having a wonderful time. There's this great Irish proverb: is this a private fight or can anybody enter? And that question about if things are so bad, why don't you just party, used to bother me a lot until I realized that the question, the premise is, there we go again, that a premise of that question is that it really reveals nothing more nor less than an incapacity to love. Because if you love, you do what's appropriate to defend your beloved. And of course results matter to you, but they don't matter to whether you make the effort. I got this email from this guy not very long ago saying that his son is 15 years old and he's wonderfully active, working for social justice and ecological sanity and all those groovy things. And the problem is that he didn't know how to give his son hope, and he wanted his son to stay active. And I said, if you want your son to stay active, don't give him hope, give him love, and he'll stay active. Because hope, once again, is the whole powerless thing. So the other thing I want to read, there was a point to that story, I just don't remember what it was. I want to read this short, I'm not going to read this whole thing, but there's a couple lines here I really like. A wonderful thing happens when you give up on hope, which is that you realize you never needed it in the first place, kind of like a belief in a Christian heaven. You realize that giving up on hope didn't kill you nor even make you less effective. In fact, it made you more effective because you ceased relying on someone or something else to solve your problems. You ceased hoping your problems would somehow get solved through the magical assistance of God, the Great Mother, the Sierra Club, valiant tree sitters, brave salmon, or even the earth itself. And you just began doing what's necessary to solve the problems yourself. Okay, so that said, I have a confession to make, which is that I've been holding out on you. Quite a while ago, I had one of the most positive conversations I ever had. Makes me think it really could be possible to speed up the process of bringing down civilization. I talked with some hackers. I hope you'll forgive me if I don't tell you when or where we met or the oddly satisfying circumstances under which we met. I also won't say their names or genders, nor will I describe them. Presume they're men. Presume one of them looks like your bench partner from your high school advanced laboratory class. And the other looks strangely familiar too, like someone you saw once in the far corner of a library surrounded by books on Nestor Makhno, Emiliano Zapata, August Spies, and Albert Parsons. Or maybe it looks like someone you saw standing at the very back of an auditorium as you listened to someone speak passionately about the necessity of taking down civilization now. In any case, here I am, sitting across the table, at least you can presume I'm sitting across the table, from these folks sharing a pitcher of water at a cafe. Let's presume we're in Asheville, North Carolina. It's late, very late on a hot summer night. Let's start small, I say. Would it be possible to inflict serious economic damage on a major corporation by hacking into computer systems? You're presuming, responds the first one, let's call him Brian, that this doesn't happen already. The other, let's call him Dean, nods. I look back and forth between the two. Brian continues, it's in the corporation's best interest not let on that this stuff happens all the time. Why is that, I ask. You think they want people to know how easy it is to hack into a system? He winks, then pauses for effect. It's getting easier all the time. Take the use of wireless technologies that have come on strong these past few years. See that thermostat over there? He points to the far side of the room. Those are oftentimes computerized and send and receive signals through the air from a main system. The other day, I hacked into the main computer of a major corporation through the thermostat. My jaw drops. He throws back his head and laughs and says, I didn't do anything. I was just trying to see if I could do it. But could you have done damage? Oh, yeah. How? Name a nasty corporation, he says. Ha, says Dean. Name one that isn't. Freeport McMoRan is pretty nasty. They both shake their heads. Most polluting company in the United States pollutes all over the world, machine guns natives in Erie and Giant, imprisons others in shipping crates. Dean looks at me intently before asking, how does it make its money? Mainly mining. Gold in Indonesia, sulfur in the Gulf of Mexico, other minerals too. Okay, Dean says, piece of cake. What do you do, I ask? Mess with their bank accounts, pretend it's Fight Club and destroy their credit card accounts? Brian wrinkles his nose. Dean says, shipping. All the shipping these days is computerized. Brian interrupts to ask, did you know the U.S. economy almost ground to a halt last year? What? I exclaim. The dock workers strike on the West Coast, Dean says. The big companies couldn't get their raw materials and parts. They were within a day or two of running out. Do you know what happens then? It's clear the question's rhetorical. He asks another question. Do you know how much it would cost GM to shut down its assembly line? I have no idea. Millions of dollars per minute. Jesus, I say. No, Brian responds, dock workers. Or, Dean says, hackers. Let's say Freeport McMoRan ships through Singapore. Singapore is the most automated port in the world. What happens if you reroute canister after canister headed for New Orleans instead to Honduras, Belize, Istanbul? The people who work for these companies, Brian adds, rely more on computers than common sense. They have to. The companies are so big, the movements of people and resources so complicated, that people can't keep track of it all. Last month, I hacked into the security system of a major corporation and had the computer issue me an ID card. I went to the company headquarters, swiped the card, and it okayed me to enter. I walked over to security people and told them I was a hacker who just breached their security. They refused to believe me. They said the computer okayed me, so I should just quit joking and head on in. I tried to persuade them, but nothing I said convinced them to listen to me. Do you think, I asked, that hackers could do more than just mess with a big corporation or two? Brian smiles. You're presuming again that nobody's already doing this. No, I say. Do you think they could bring it all down, could take down civilization? Brian nods, and so does Dean. Dean says, I've spent the past 20 years studying how the economic system works. I don't mean economic theory, although I certainly understand that, but rather the nuts and bolts of it, transport of raw materials like we were talking about with those canisters. And the thing that amazes me is that the system hasn't already collapsed. It's incredibly fragile, incredibly vulnerable. As Dean talks, Brian pulls what looks like a walkie-talkie from a holster on his belt. The walkie-talkie has a small LED. Suddenly the machine squawks and the light turns green. Guess what, Brian says, somebody in Nashville is receiving a page. He pulls a hand calculator from another holster and punches a few buttons. He shows me the screen. I read information about the page. He smiles proudly, then says, I made a few minor modifications. I ask, why do you do this? It makes me giddy to figure things out. I love the rush when I suddenly understand something new. I know the feeling. I feel what I'd imagine is the same rush whenever I suddenly get the relationship, for example, between pornography and science. I ask, if you love computers, would you take it down? Dean says, yes. Brian says, in a heartbeat. Why? Do you know where they put computer books in bookstores, Brian asks? In the business section. And? Computers were supposed to set us free. That was the rhetoric. That's always the rhetoric. But they've just been used to further enslave us, to further enslave the poor, to further enslave the planet. I become aware of the silence in the room. I take a sip of water. Brian continues, let's say you have a soldering iron that you love to use. You love soldering pieces of metal together. You love burning beautiful designs into pieces of wood furniture. Now, what would you do if somebody started using that soldering iron to torture people? I can't speak for you or anybody else, but I would pull the plug on the iron. I'd do that, he repeats, in a heartbeat. A soft sound breaks the silence of the cafe. Across the room, the lone employee has begun stacking chairs on tables. Brian says, I'm in love with figuring out how things work, and the existence or non-existence of machines doesn't mean we can't figure things out. If I smash this calculator, that doesn't invalidate Ohm's law. Ohm's law is still there. Nature is still there under all the concrete, under all these machines. And if you've gone outside during a blackout, the lights are still there, but they're up in the sky. And it's so quiet, you can finally start to hear. I ask again, and you'd be willing to help bring it down? The woman is stacking chairs closer. We don't have much time. They both laugh and say, of course. You've thought about this a lot. Again, both laugh and say, of course. I have to know. If they were dedicated enough and knew what they were doing, how many people do you think it would take to bring it all down? Brian says, it would take far fewer than Jesus had apostles. The woman has stacked all the chairs but ours. Dean says, let's go. I nod and say, it's late. It is... What? Okay, there's one more thing I want to say. And then we'll do like 30 seconds of Q&A. I'll ask one question. And I'll ask it myself and answer it myself. There we go. Okay, so there's one more thing I do want to talk about, which is there was a woman who came to one of my talks in Eugene. Actually came to two of my talks on the same day because in both of them she wanted to accuse me of being a combination of Mao and Stalin. Because bringing down civilization is all nice and theoretical, but the truth is there will someday be a lot fewer people on the planet than there are now. And so she was basically accusing me of wanting to commit mass murder by wanting to bring down civilization. And the first thing I said is, of course, the people of... I was talking to Anuradha Mittal a few years ago, and I said, would the people of India be better off if the U.S. economy disappeared tomorrow? And she said, of course they would. And the example she gave, and this has to do with Europe, but it's the same deal, there are former granaries of India that are now exporting dog food and tulips to Europe, and there are people in India starving to death because of that. So that's one thing. And another thing is that the idea of bringing down civilization is not a monolithic act. I mean, I don't care if you are an anarcho-primitivist or a U.S. soldier, blowing up a children's hospital is an atrocity. It doesn't matter who you are and or what your motivation is. And at the same time, I think it's really hard to make a moral case against taking out cell phone towers. Cell phone towers kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds a year. And, I mean, sure, we can make up a case. So we got this woman driving along late at night, and her car dies out on this lonely country road, and so she dials 911. The cop says he's going to come and help her start a car. And she turns on the radio, and she hears that this homicidal maniac just escaped from a prison. He's got a hook on his arm. And then the cop comes, and he starts the car, and she drives away. And the next morning, when she goes out and looks at her car, there's this bloody hook hanging from the arm. And it's just like, whew. Cell phone should stay up. But on the other hand, you got this story. You got this woman driving down the road late at night. She calls her mom, and her mother's this elderly woman who falls down the stairs and breaks her leg, and then grabs the phone and says, "Please call 911. I'm lying on the floor in tremendous pain." Fortunately, the woman has two cell phones, so she dials 911 with the other cell phone. But then she's, of course, driving with no hands, and she veers off the road. She hits three orphans and then runs into a tree. And the last thing she sees before she passes out is this hook gleaming in the moonlight. The point being that, you know, you can make up hypotheticals for, you know, to make yourself do or not do any action. But there are some actions that it'd be really hard to make a moral case against. That said, I still couldn't proceed with the book because someday, because humans are over carrying capacity. The primary problem isn't population anyway. The primary problem is a worldview based on a refusal to acknowledge limits, but the secondary problem is consumption, and the tertiary problem is population. But in any case, there'll be less people. So what are we going to do about that? What does that mean? I couldn't finish the book until I had... It's like, I don't want to gloss over it. That's a huge, huge thing. How are we going to get there? And I finally came up with an answer that really works for me. If you've got... And the point really also is if you're civilized, your hands are bloody. So there's no way we can step away. I mean, you can't just sit here... I got a call a couple years ago from this woman at WGBH, a producer for the public radio or public TV show there. She said she was going to do a program on Kaczynski, but she wanted to make sure that she didn't glorify a killer. And I said, that's so good. I'm so glad you're not going to glorify a killer. And I hope that if you did a biography of George Bush or Bill Clinton or Al Gore, you would hold them to the same standards. And she said, I have no idea what you're talking about, which, of course, is why she's a producer for WGBH. And then I said, you know, look, do you pay taxes? She said, yes. And I said, well, in that case, you've killed way more people than Ted Kaczynski because, of course, you support the U.S. military. And oddly enough, I didn't end up in a documentary. anyway, so the point is, we're all inculpated, which we could talk about if we had more time. Anyway, if you've gotten this far in the book, we probably agree that civilization's going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't believe that, we probably have nothing to say to each other. How about them cubbies? We probably also agree that the crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner it comes down, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. So these are the premises. If you agree civilization's not going to last, if you agree the crash is going to be messy, and if you agree that the longer we wait, the worse it's going to be, because if you agree with all those, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring it down, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization is going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan and they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people... Thank you. We need people... You can clap about it, but you can't do it. We need people to... That was a joke, Mr. Ashcroft. We need people to protest and chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that although I don't believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, people growing medicinal plants do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. They especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love, do what you can, do what best serves your land base. We need it all. This doesn't mean that everyone taking out dams and everyone working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. I have a new catchphrase: dismantle globally, renew locally. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. This doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas or that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what'll work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It is contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. So, thank you.